Hey, podcast listeners, Mark Thame here, host of AI JCast. Before we get into this episode, just wanted to make a quick announcement. Due to some changes in our production schedule, today will not feature photographer Stephanie Ely as we had originally announced. That episode is now slated for a couple of weeks from now. It's a great conversation. Look forward to it. Instead, on this episode, we feature storyteller and social entrepreneur Melvin Bray. Another great conversation. And I want to make one more plug. We are grateful for everybody that has filled out our survey. If you have not yet had a chance to do so, just go to our website, aijcast.com. It'll be up there only for a couple more days. And we have some incredible things coming out of what it is that you want to see next for AI JCast. Thank you for your support. Listen on. Peace. Hello, welcome to AI JCast, a podcast featuring conversations and performances at the intersection of art, inspiration, and justice. I'm your host, Mark Thame Sanders. Our guest is Melvin Bray. He is an Emmy Award-winning storyteller, writer, educator, and social entrepreneur. His latest project is his book entitled Better, Waking Up to Who We Could Be. Melvin and I got a chance to sit down in Midtown Atlanta recently and talk. Melvin Bray, welcome to AI JCast.
Thank you so much for having me, Martha.
So let's start by digging back into your background. There are several strands that just kind of run through your life and your narrative, of which writing and storytelling keep coming up again and again and again.
Yes.
Can you talk about where that got into your DNA, into your lifeblood?
I guess I would have to fault my mother. She used to read to me at night.
How dare she?
How dare she, right? Going to bed, she'd read stories, and for some reason, story mattered a great deal to me. You know, and of course, as a kid, you don't really know why a thing is a thing
sure.
for you, but nonetheless, right? Like, being able to hear stories as I got older, I'd go to sleep listening to stories.
Mm. In what sense you mean go to sleep listening to stories?
Yeah, like so what was really big early on was kind of fairy tales.
The Three Little Pigs. Once upon a time, there were three little pigs.
And you know, we had old record player back then,
yeah.
right? So this would have been the 70s, right?
Yeah.
So we had
yeah.
record players with stories, and we put the record on it. With all that static in the background, and then you listen to it. When I was about five, my mother joined a church
uh-huh.
that became really important in my upbringing. And so then kind of sacred myth,
okay.
Bible stories
yeah.
kind of found their way into my life. And so she'd read from this series of Bible stories, and I'd listen to those. And I just had a knack for remembering stuff.
Mm.
I watched probably way more TV than I needed to. But at some point later in life, I realized I was, again, watching for story,
huh.
like how story was constructed, how heroes functioned, protagonists and antagonists, how they functioned,
yeah.
how ideas were developed, how stories were complicated, and what it meant for something to happen that needed to be resolved, and
right.
how things were working themselves out. And I mean, it was it became so much a part of my life that when I got to college, after trying several different kinds of study paths, I ended up in literature,
yeah.
and I became a language arts teacher.
Yeah,
right. Just so I could spend my days telling stories.
Telling stories. Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly what that was.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because a friend of mine who's a preacher talks about. He says film is the American parable.
Yeah, yeah. I believe that. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I think the way film works, television works, is the same way that any good story has ever worked. It helps us begin to understand who we are.
Yeah.
In relationship to one another. It helps us begin to get some aspiration about who we'd like to be.
Hmm.
It helps us begin to understand kind of the limits
mm-hmm.
that kind of constrain and shape possibilities in our lives. And so, you know, a lot of film has set for us boundaries as that say there is no other way than this way of being in the world, right? So
right.
So in the United States, I think where that kind of shows up most potently, at least for me, is around our sense of equity.
Okay.
And how certain stories reaffirm the kind of inequity uh-huh. in which our society has been rooted and formed, and don't give us a sense of imagination that something else is possible. We kind of walk in this idea, well, this is the way it is. It's as good as it gets, you know, this kind of thing. It reinforces certain mythic notions about the good that we think we're about.
Uh-huh.
Even though our history doesn't bear that we've ever been about that stuff, all of that kind
absolutely
of film works that way.
Can you think of, whether it's film or television or anything else, a story that does exactly what you're talking about, reinforcing things it shouldn't? And I'm also interested if you can think of a story that breaks that deconstructs that a little bit in a helpful way.
So I can tell you, talking about film, and again, my understanding of story and storytelling has a lot to do with kind of how sacred myth works, but uh-huh. also how our public and communal myths work, and so on and so forth. But staying in the category of film for a moment, I can tell you that it caught my attention when in the movie, what was it called? Was it Blood Diamond?
Yeah.
When the black man didn't die. And when the choice was made by the white male protagonist that his responsibility at the end of everything, usually the responsibility of the white male protagonist in any film is to triumph.
Right.
Right. So it's the Rocky narrative.
Right.
And we have these kinds of cultural myths that come up in every generation, from Tarzan to Rocky to Fast and Furious, right? Like that re-indoctrinate us, re-enshrine in the American imagination this notion of who is to triumph. But in that movie, for one of the first times that I had seen, the man who was meant to triumph said, I am going to use that privilege that I have and create the space for this man and his son
right
to dream their way forward, to have different possibility, because otherwise the system in which we find ourselves is going to eat them up and spit them out.
Right.
And so you have that scene in the movie where Leonardo DiCaprio says, you all get away, and he stood there and he held off the guys who were chasing him.
Yeah,
that was a first.
You take your boy home, huh? You take him home.
You do have movies that are like that disrupt the more common narratives and offer us other ways of being in the world. And when we begin to see, and when that happens, then it creates different imagination in us and other things become possible that before we didn't imagine were possible.
I think that speaks to that whole point about it being parable.
So
when you look at the sacred narratives, the sacred stories, where do you see that disruptive possibility?
Oh, shoot. I see it all throughout, right? Like, so here's the thing. Most of us are not very conscious of how sacred myth works in our lives, right? So first off, when I use the term myth, a lot of people think I'm talking about lie.
Right.
And I'm not, right? Like, that's not what the word myth has ever meant.
Right.
As an English teacher, though, when I was talking about myth to my students, what I was trying to communicate to them was, these are the stories around which people organize their lives.
Sure. Yeah.
And so sacred stories are those first stories, those oldest stories around which people organize their lives. And so we have for me, the sacred narrative is a Judeo-Christian narrative.
Okay.
And there are a lot of assumptions that have been made that these stories are about the triumph of those who are favored by God.
Mm-hmm.
over those who are not.
Mm-hmm.
And much of how I receive those stories in my upbringing were to reinforce that narrative.
Right.
But
which reinforces that same narrative that we've been talking about in the culture.
Exactly,
writ large.
Right? Yeah. In the culture, right? So you know, this notion that Israel's possession, the nation of Israel going to take over Canaan,
right,
which is now kind of what we think of when we say Middle East, particularly yeah. around the Fertile Crescent. So we're talking about Palestine and Saudi Arabia and some of Egypt down in there and Jordan and so on and so forth, right? So when that was read to me as a kid in church, the notion was just like Israel was meant to take this land from these other people, so too it was right and appropriate for Americans, and when we say Americans, we really mean people of European descent, people of European descent to take over the North America. It is right and it is just for Christians to kind of have a position of dominance and say within American culture, even though we are supposed to be a country that does not give preference to any particular religion. So this was how it was handed down to me.
Yeah.
But the mistake folk made was they introduced me to the story of Jesus.
Right? That's the fly in the ointment, isn't it?
That's the fly in the ointment, yeah. Right? And the story of Jesus kind of radicalized me. Because here was a dude who was saying like, yeah, I know that's the story you think this is. That's not the story.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and that's that whole, that going, the kingdom of God is at hand and you get to participate in it.
Yeah.
And how does this thing work? Well, you know, we're going to seek the good of other peoples. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You know, right. This kind of thing. Love your enemies. Pray for them who curse you. Do good to those who despitefully use you. It's all this turning stuff on the head. So what that made me do was go back to the stories and say, like, is this kind of hostility towards the rest of the world inherent in the stories, in the way that the Hebrew storytellers told them?
Mm.
Or is that something we brought to the table?
Mm.
And I begin to see a good bit of that was stuff we brought to the table.
Hmm.
And some of it was actually there.
Right.
Right. Like when we look at the gender inequity that's in kind of those old Judeo-Christian myths, it's serious. I mean, it's there. But you also see this at work in these spaces, this usurping of that kind of dominant narrative at every turn, at every turn. So those Hebrew storytellers, man, they were a subversive bunch of folk.
Well, and that's the beauty of the story, is that you can find that within it, and you can have these subversive moments even when people don't even recognize that that's what you're doing.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, right? So you end up with, you take a story like the story of Adam and Eve.
Mm.
Let's start with the first story in the book. And there's a whole lot of kind of theological inequity that we build into that.
You know,
it's the story of Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. It's the story about a particular people who did a particular thing, and because they did a particular thing, God blessed them.
Right.
And everybody else that did another different thing, God did not bless. Well, okay, that's one way of reading the story.
Yeah.
Right? But if you look at the story, one of the first things that jumps off the page is that, first off, there's two tellings of the creation myth.
Right.
That's right there at the beginning of the book, as if to say, this is not about being right about God. Right? Like, it's just not. It might be about a lot of things, but it's not about being right about God. The second thing that jumps out is this beautiful language in the more grandiose version of the creation story, where there's this like, and God made this. And God made that, and God made the other thing, each after its kind.
Mm-hmm.
As if to say, as if the Hebrew storytellers were saying, God is as in love with the diversity of creation as he is with the act of creating.
Hmm.
So this is not a story about you have to be this, or you have to be that, or you have to be, God made this thing.
Mm.
And so how do we learn to appreciate this deep beauty? Right, inherent in the story is are tellings of what happens when folk try to claim God for themselves.
Right.
There's this very unique kind of statement, commentary at the end of the story of Cain and Abel. And the story of Cain and Abel, you might remember, is about two brothers.
Right.
One kills the other.
Right.
And the way that we usually tell that story is to say, you know, one killed the other because he didn't want to do right and he didn't appreciate his brother doing right. And so he rose up against his brother. But if you listen deeply, the God character in that story is constantly calling that interpretation into question.
Into question.
He's saying, like, if you do right, won't right come?
Mm.
So why are you worried about these folk,
right,
who keep telling you that the right path is to mimic them?
Mm.
At the end of that story, there's this piece of commentary that's just amazing. It says this was about the time that people started to claim God for themselves, right? Which so all of that kind of stuff, right? Like I'm geeking out on some of the theological stuff, right? Right, but all of that kind of stuff is inherent in the stories.
Yeah.
And so that's what, you know, so I, the work I've done as an adult is actually trying to go back to those stories to see how the particular narratives that we've been given, what they affirm, what they try to cultivate, and then to ask the question, is there something more beautiful, more just, more virtue-filled? And if there is, then let me find that.
Mm. Reminds me a little bit of Kenneth Bailey, who was a New Testament scholar who grew up in the Middle East, American by citizenship, but born in Cairo, lived in Lebanon, and he was an exquisite scholar of Middle Eastern Christian scholarship, which had been kind of buried.
Yeah, yeah.
And so began
because what would they know about Christianity? I mean, Christianity was just born there, right?
Like,
you know, what would they know about that?
Yeah, the Germans are clearly going to be better. Scholars about this stuff. So he goes in and he lifts up these Middle Eastern cultural understandings of these parables. And it's just beautiful. And things like the prodigal son.
Yes.
The father takes up his robe, gathers it up, and runs to meet him.
Yeah.
What no other audience in the world would understand, especially not an American westernized audience, is the father, the very act of the father running is a shameful act.
Yes.
So the shame that should fall on the son, the father takes on for himself.
And thereby, there at the edge of the town, we find him authentically repenting, accepting the love that is offered to him, and not saying, my bright ideas will solve the problem.
So that's the work I do as an adult. That's the work I do in Better. Trying to recognize those things. And then also trying to ask the question, like, so then what does this, if we can find more just, more beautiful, more virtuous tellings of these stories that have shaped us, and organize ourselves around these more just, virtuous, and beautiful ways of being in the world, how does that change the world?
Mm.
What difference does that make in how we as people of faith show up in the world? Because I truly believe that unless, as people of faith, we find better ways of showing up in the world, our children don't need to be bothered with faith.
Mm.
It's just done too much damage.
Mm.
If you think about every single war we've ever fought, there is some faith-based foolishness.
Okay.
Behind all of it. So, you know, if you think about the notion of gender inequity, for most people, it's based in some bad theology.
Right, right.
Right, if you think about racism, heterosexism, if you think about how we treat people who are gender nonconforming, some religious bullshit is at the root of that thing.
Mm.
So when I see that kids are leaving the faith of their parents in droves, there's a part of me that says, why shouldn't they?
Right.
And if we want to see something different, then by God, the burden of proof is on us as people who still value faith to show that it can be of some good in the world.
Tell me about how being a father, being a parent, shapes what you just said. That you came to church because your mother came to church and it became an important part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are passing on your mythology to your children. So tell me about that transformation within you, but also as a parent, kind of how you go about negotiating that with your kids.
So definitely my kids are my motivation for the work I do. I refuse to hand them the world that was passed down to me if there's anything I can do about it.
Mm.
So whether it be this kind of storytelling, artistic work, or whether it be kind of my consulting practice, it is rooted in the notion of creating a better world for my kids. It was actually trying to read my kids the stories that my mom used to read to me that hit me to the fact that I was giving my kids something I didn't believe in.
Wow.
There was just so much triumphalism there. We gonna be on top.
Right.
Our God is better than your God.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
So it's like the children's Bible version. I mean, is that what you're talking about?
Well, the children's Bible version and just kind of just like reading from the Bible and reading from these stories and hearing how my children, the existence of my children made me conscious of how people told the story.
Right.
Yeah. So I started as I was reading to them, as I was hearing these tellings, I'm like, that's not something I want to see in my kids.
Hmm.
I don't want to see my kids out here trying to dominate the world or somehow disqualifying folk who don't resolve their stories the same way they do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like just all this kind of thing. It was like, no, I don't want to see that. And so that's what kind of got me in this space where I started asking people who I knew didn't hold faith as adults the same way they held it as children.
Mm-hmm.
I started asking, so how are you telling this story differently?
Right.
How are you telling that story differently? What do you see when you hear about Moses in Pharaoh's court, or when you read Sodom and Gomorrah?
Mm-hmm.
God negotiates down. If I can find 10 righteous people, he's talking to this guy named Abraham. If I can find 100 good people, maybe 50, maybe 20, about 10.
Right.
Right. 10, will you spare the city? Okay. If I can find 10 good people in Sodom and Gomorrah, I'll spare the city. The city goes up in flames. Oh well.
There's only 9.
There were only 9. You know, like, how are you telling these stories differently? How are you telling the story of Noah, the story of a God who got so pissed off with humanity, he destroyed the world.
Right.
And only a few people made it, and they sat there in their boat feeling self-righteous about it. Well, you should have come in as they were listening to folk die.
Right. Oh, wow. Yeah.
How are you telling these stories? This is what I started doing. And I started recording people as they told, as they shared with me their different tellings. When I hear that, as one of Noah's sons, I'm immediately bounding up to the outer deck, tying a rope around my waist and the shorter end around a sturdy post, then venturing out on the deck, casting the length of the rope overboard for anyone who could grab hold. I couldn't be satisfied with my own safety inside. At least, I don't want to be a person who could. I don't know how one should best imagine that part of the story. What I do know for sure, for the first time in my life, is that Noah's family's first night on the ark adrift was not a happy one. No one was thinking, at least we're safe. Everyone, every one of them, if they are meant to be anything like the Elohim who loved enough to plan in advance a means of salvation for them, every one of them cried their own flood of tears
for the lives lost that day.
I started thinking about how it is that different people I knew would kind of, because of where they were, would kind of end up with ways of telling the story that were different than kind of how they were handed down. So what is it about us that makes us resolve the story this way? I started paying attention to is there a methodology in this thing? And in conversation with a buddy of mine by the name of Russell Rathman, who's a preacher up in Minneapolis, Lutheran pastor, who every week he doesn't just preach a sermon. He actually goes into character and tells a story, acts out a story. And so started talking to him about how do you get at it? And how do I, and came up with this idea of this methodology called the compost method, right? Stories that compost. And so kind of got into that. And so then kind of took that and went back with my kids. And pretty much my wife and I, we decided, you know, our lives were very steeped in kind of religion and religious tradition. And we wanted to pass along faith, but we weren't so sure we wanted to pass along religion. I grew up in a fundamentalist upbringing, so you know I'm a recovering fundamentalist. Everybody was going to hell unless you resolve the story exactly.
Yeah, you were not on the boat.
You weren't on the boat, and I wasn't throwing any ropes or life rafts out to you. It wasn't happening. So we decided we didn't want our kids to have that. So our question became, can we pass faith along without steeping our children in kind of the religious tradition in which we were brought up?
Okay.
And so we said, okay, we will, and we're going to do it multiple ways. But basically the baseline of it was we're going to immerse them in the story of what it means to be people who walk in the way of Jesus without immersing them in the tradition about that. So it involved telling them a lot of stories, taking them a lot of places, involving them in a lot of things where people were just living lives that seemed beautiful to us. And so that's kind of how we have raised our children, somewhat of an experiment.
Sure.
Our oldest is 14.
Okay.
So we'll see what happens. Some of what has come about, we like. Some of it, I don't know about that. But, you know, I think all parents are going through a little bit of that as kids kind of enter into those teen years.
Yeah. Melvin Bray on AIJCast. We'll be back to more of my conversation with him in just a moment. But first, a quick word. Hey, have I mentioned our survey? I have. Well, I'm mentioning it again. If you haven't already filled it out, we are looking for input from our listeners. AIJCast.com. Click on the link that says survey. 10 questions, 5 minutes. Thank you. We'll be running it through the end of July. A quick look at our calendar. On Friday, August 25th, the film Voiceless will have its debut screening at the Center for Civil and Human Rights in Atlanta. The film features previous guest Terrence Lester of Love Beyond Walls and his walk from Atlanta to Washington, D.C. to raise awareness around homelessness. Other screenings have already been scheduled. You can check our website for more information. On Sunday, August 27th, Axum Dance Theater Experience will be presenting My Faith at the Southwest Arts Center. That's at 4 p.m. Previous guest David Lamott will be a featured speaker at TEDx Asheville in September. In October, Marianne McKibben Dana and I will be co-presenting a workshop at Columbia Seminary, October 10 through 12. We will also be on stage the night of October 11th. You can find out more information on our website. We are continually updating our artist calendar. You can always find out more information on our website, aijcast.com. And now back to more of my conversation with Melvin Bray.
Part of your story, and you hinted at this earlier, was in education. You were a teacher for many years.
Yeah, about 20 years.
20 years. And tell me about how that, the rewards and the challenges of that, and how it led to you moving in this new direction.
Teaching was great. Teaching is always great in terms of dealing with kids. At least that was my experience. It's the grown folk that annoy the heck out of me. I mean, there is so much we put on teachers. And so when I say grown people, I mean from parents, but not really or just parents, but, you know, just like kind of the systems we've built up around education. There's so much we put on teachers that has nothing to do with actually teaching. that has to do with documentation and record keeping,
right,
and following a particular course of study, whether or not it is meaningful or successful or useful.
Or pedagogically sound. Or anything.
Pedagogically sound, yeah. Right? Right, that kind of thing. So all of that just kind of got the best of me, and that's why I ended up leaving. But while I was there, I mean, I loved it, and I won awards, and I got a chance to experiment with different things. I started off as a language arts teacher, and so taught literature and composition, taught journalism, taught drama, and, you know, used to love being in the class. You know, I had The Story of the Pearl by John Steinbeck, and the kids hadn't read the assignment. It's really no use asking them, so what do you think the character was thinking when the character did this? They don't know what the character did, right? So I'd make sure I got my reading in the night before, and I'd come in and I'd tell the story, and I'd climb the cabinets in my classroom to embody what it meant for this man to be on this precipice, yeah, to go in search of this pearl, you know, this kind of thing. So I used to love that. That was fabulous. Got a chance to do that, did some leadership education. But finally, I was teaching this leadership course at one time. I guess this is the late 90s. And we had been in class for a little while, and a student of mine who never missed class wasn't there. And I was asking if anybody knew where she was. No one knew. Finally, she came in the class, and she sat down very quietly and put her head down and started crying. I mean, just sobbing, deep sobs. And so I set the class to work, and I went to talk to her. We went outside. And she looked me in my eyes, and she said, "Mr. Bray, my mom left." And in my young naivete, I was like, "What you mean she left? She went to the store or what?" Right, you know, right, what I mean? Like, right, you know, I'm trying to complete the thought so we can get on back in here. She said, "No, my mom left, and we don't know if she's coming back."
Wow.
And again, I couldn't wrap my brain around this thing. Like, how do you not know if she's coming back?
Right.
Well, she did this before, and she was gone 5 years.
Wow.
What? So, like, do you have, where's your dad?
Right.
Do you have grandparents? Like, what's your situation here? Well, my brothers and I, there's three of us, we have three different fathers. Mm. We stay with our grandmother. So we're okay, except she doesn't want to take care of us.
Mm.
Like she did it the last time. Mm. And she's old now, and she just doesn't want to be bothered. I am sitting here losing my mind, trying to figure out, now, what the hell does 1 + 1 = 2 matter,
right,
for a child who's 15 years old, trying to figure out how to get in touch with the biological fathers of her brothers so she can get them into a situation where they'll be cared for.
Right.
What does my insistence on how to speak properly and how to write well and stuff, what does that mean for her when she has all this real life stuff to navigate?
Yeah.
So that kind of drove me. That experience slowly but surely drove me out of the classroom because I wanted to get into a place where I was dealing with stuff that that actually mattered, that made a difference for that kid.
Mm.
So I left the classroom, got into kind of leadership development work. That evolved into kind of eco-literacy work. Weird. evolution, but that's what it did. It evolved into eco-literacy and started getting kids out in nature, putting their hands in the dirt and recognizing how that impacted the way that they functioned in the classroom. So what that did was that got me thinking about what's at the root of stuff.
Yeah.
And if you're going to change something, like how do you get to the root? And so, you know, kind of did the eco-literacy thing for a while, back and forth in the classroom, did some administrative work, came back to the eco-literacy, and then ended up, started hanging out with a bunch of folk doing justice work. So these are people who are very consciously involved in nonprofit and organizing work around social justice, all kinds of campaigns. And they'd ask me what I do. And it suddenly, it started dawning on me that what I did was I create fertility in the minds of young people so that when you come to them asking them to do this social justice work, they get it. Because that's what this work with the earth and gardening and farming and stuff, that's what it did, right? Like it taught kids how to respect, because we were dealing with organic farming, it taught kids how to respect the natural rhythms of things. And because it taught them how to respect the natural rhythms of things, they began to recognize when things were out of natural balance. And so inequity started to be apparent to them. And so when you came and you said that these people on this side of town should have the same quality of education as these people on the other side of town, and the only difference is the race of the people that live on the two sides of town and the economic the economics of the two different communities, all of a sudden they could see that.
Right.
And they were ready to do something about it. And they understood, they had like this natural intuition of the kinds of correctives that needed to happen in order for, because it wasn't about putting a Band-Aid on it, it was about getting things back in kind of balance with one another. Sustainability was the language we would use then. And so that started a slow kind of pulling. So out of the classroom, into eco-literacy, now into actual justice, social justice work. And so that's what I do now nowadays. I do consultants. I consult with folk who for whom equity, diversity, and inclusion are important in the way they do their work, or they want to restructure in order for it to be important.
I'm curious, as you do that work, how often do you find that privilege is the barrier to getting that information out?
Oh, quite often, right? But another way of looking at it, right? So I use all that language, privilege and supremacist logic, and you know, I can kind of talk about that critical race theory, or look at it in terms of economic inequity or so on and so forth. But the truth is, it's all rooted in narratives. In stories, right? So this is where it comes full circle.
Right.
Scripts out of which we are acting that for some say we're going to be on top. No matter the situation, we're going to be on top.
Great again.
And whether we are conscious of it or not, we seek that topness. For others, it's we're going to be all right, or we shall overcome. And so no matter the situation, it's always the pie in the sky by and by.
The moral arc of the universe.
Yeah, the moral arc of the universe will eventually bend towards justice.
Right.
For others, it's that immigrant narrative that if you come here, you work hard, you do, then that's deeply, that deeply roots them in an affirmation of a system that exists, whether or not that system
is just,
seeks their good or is just at all, right? So all of those narratives, we're all operating, and privilege is one of those narratives, right? And we operate out of them, and so we keep, no matter where we go, we recreate the same structural inequities because we never challenge the narrative. And so much of my work is about getting people to recognize their assumptions that are embedded in their narratives and to rewrite those narratives, a future by design, and not by default.
Can you think of an example where that kind of thing has come to the where you've worked with a group through a problem like that?
Oh, sure, right. So I did some work in the PCUSA with a group that was questioning kind of the equity, diversity, and inclusion in their programming, and so they were looking at how do we build more equity here. And one of the exercises I do with folk, is called Better Stories, Better Scripts. I find out what's going on with them, like what are the trigger points, what's happening. And I'll take whatever that trigger point is, and I'll weave it into a little paragraph of a scenario or a story, where you imagine yourself in the near future, such as such is happening. These things are starting to develop, and all of a sudden, something goes wrong, the way it always goes wrong, right? So-and-so feels like he or she is the one who gets to say the most.
Right.
Right?
Right, right, right.
Or so-and-so feel like he or she is the one that gets to, for whom the situation needs to work out. And you know, if it doesn't work out for other people, oh well. So whatever goes wrong, and what I invite people to do is write a better ending to this story. Mm-hmm. So they get together in these small groups and they write a better ending. Well, this group, programming group, one of the scenarios involved, you have a person who's been a counselor here in years past. Rave reviews. It's been great. Summer camp for youth. They reapply the next year. And the next year when they show up for their interview, they're in the middle of transition, gender transition. So how you gonna handle it? What you going to do about it? The board has come back and it's pitching a fit. So-and-so funders are talking about they're about to pull out. Right. You know, this and that is about to happen. And stuff is falling apart. What are you going to do? Well, the leadership of this organization got together and they started thinking about it. And they started working through what's going to be our strategy with our board, and what's going to be our strategy with our parents, and what's going to be our strategy with our students, and what's going to be our strategy among the staff, and what kind of education do we need, and what kind of communication policy do we need, PR's work, and all this other stuff. It was great. 2 months later, they're taking applications.
Oh my gosh.
And it happens.
Wow.
It happens. But they'd already thought through it.
Yeah.
So it was just like, oh, we got this.
Okay.
We're going to handle this. And so they were able to do it with such grace, such beauty, such affirmation of their camp counselor. Affirmation of concerns of some folk, the fact that some people needed to part ways with some people, that's fine. Educating their board well. I mean, it was wonderful because they had taken this time to kind of to design a future for themselves rather than just kind of go into it by default.
Wow. I didn't realize you were a prophet. That's
Now, of course, the way I remember it is they were the exact same scenario. I think they weren't exactly the same. There's something about it that was different, but the work had been done.
But
the myth
is what persists.
That's right. So that's it.
So tell me a little bit about what you have done and are doing with Wild Goose, Wild Goose Festival.
I'm not.
You were.
I was. I was one of the founding board members of the Wild Goose, was a part of helping them kind of craft that story. There were ways in which the Goose was able to imagine a more beautiful world.
Mm-hmm.
There were ways in which it wasn't. And I guess for me, what ended up happening, which often happens, when people are trying to craft a more equitable, just and inclusive world, is it's relatively easy to allow one person to own that. Particularly if it happens to be the person of color or otherwise historically marginalized identity. It's easy to let them own that. But what had to happen for the Wild Goose was that I needed to step away so that more people could own that. So that it could really blossom if it was going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often with a lot of organizations, particularly historically white, affluent organizations, faith-based organizations, there is a whole lot of incentive to go so far but no further.
Hmm.
When it comes to what it means to try to wrestle with structural inequity, not just how I feel, because we all have learned, at least publicly, to feel well against each
other. Sure, sure.
Toward one another.
Civility.
Yeah, civility.
Yeah.
There's a way we kind of handle the PR of that.
Yeah.
But what does it mean to actually create mechanisms, to create structures that produce equitable results, equitable material results? Because kind of people like their stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you steal all the land,
mm-hmm.
who's going to give it back?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like, what do you do about that?
Yeah.
Right. But if you can't wrestle with the fact that you're on stolen land,
right. Then
you can't get towards justice.
Mm.
Right. When you build $6.4 trillion, and that's a conservative estimate of wealth on the back of black bodies.
Right.
Then what do you do when it's 100 years later, actually 150 years later, and you never did anything to redistribute that
mm-hmm.
wealth?
Mm-hmm.
But you want folk to get over it, to move on.
The 40 acres and mule never materialized.
No.
Yeah.
And the inequities still persist,
sure.
Right? So the average black family in the United States has $11,000 worth of wealth.
Yeah.
Well, that's average.
Yeah.
Whereas the average white family in the United States has about $130,000 worth of wealth, right? Whether it be in their house, mm-hmm. in assets, mm-hmm. family assets, whatever the case may be, right? Well, that's the same.
Yeah.
Degree of disparity that existed 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? And it was more radical before that.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the point being, right, the reason these things persist is because we only so far and no further. We're not actually going to work on the results. We're going to work on how we feel.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the work I think needs to be done now, why I do the consultancy work that I do, why I stepped away from the Wild Goose, is to help create the space where more people could hold the results as being dependent on who they are and how they choose to show up in the world.
Right.
We don't have a lot of experience doing it.
No.
So we don't do it terribly well.
Yeah.
But thank God there's folk trying to do it.
Yeah.
Right? Right?
Yeah.
Like who are still wrestling, screwing it up and wrestling
with
it. Right?
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 Yeah.
Nonetheless. So, yeah. Yeah.
So I want to make sure that we talk about Better.
Okay.
About your book.
Mm-hmm.
So Better, subtitle, Waking Up to Who We Could Be.
Mm-hmm.
This is, in a lot of ways, it's pulling together a lot of what we've been talking about, what you've been
exactly
doing,
it.
Right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. But this is what you need to know. This book seeks to kind of bring together these different threads that we've been talking about, right? So this justice thread, this storytelling thread, this how we show up in the world thread, bringing these things together. And it's a challenge to people of faith, but I think it's of some good to people who are spiritual but not religious,
okay.
Folk who are not people of faith but who deal with people of faith. To reimagine how they tell their stories. First, to look at with a critical eye at how they tell their stories and what it encourages, how it encourages them to show up in the world. And then to challenge them to reimagine those stories. And I give a methodology. I put forward this compost methodology as a way of doing that. And then what I do for the remainder of the book is just give examples, right? Like so chapter one is kind of the part of the conversation we just had. Mm. And then the rest of it is I pick a story and I tell it. And I actually, what first thing I do is I kind of set the context of kind of how shit is falling apart in the world. Mm-hmm. And I pick a story and I tell it. And then I go back. Now, what intuition arises out of this story that gets us away from the stuff that was falling apart and closer towards our goal of beloved community, that metaphor that Martin Luther King made popular about what it meant to interact as people who are affirming of one another and who seek equity for one another. Mm-hmm. And I do that about 8 times. And then at the end of the book, I said, this is what I did.
That's great writing.
Yeah, that's good writing.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm doing it. Here's what I did.
Here's what I did. Oh, man. You can do it too.
You can do it too. There you go.
That's exactly it. But it's just an attempt to try to fire the imagination.
Yeah.
Fire the imagination. Get us where we're looking at this notion of beloved community critically and knowing that it's not about how we feel towards one another, but rather it's about who we choose to be with one another and what are the results that we will accept and strive for in the world. I think of in both my work as a consultant and in my writing, I talk about beloved community as being more like a 12-step program than it is like an afternoon seminar. You don't just come, oh, I know about beloved community.
That's
I'm
right.
good, right?
You're good, yeah.
I'm ready to be in the world. No, right? Like that's not how, it's more like a 12-step program. Mm. It's you have to put in the work. And so I talk about there being 4 major moves, right? First, you got to develop some kind of critical analysis. Mm-hmm. Where you begin to see inequity where it resides and you stop being blind to it. The second thing you got to do is you got to develop some self-awareness. You got to figure out where you are in that structure, in that system, because as you mentioned before, right? Some people are very privileged in certain systems, right? I bring to the table a set of an education, a set of skills,
right?
My maleness, my extrovertedness, all of this serves me well and privileges me in a lot of spaces that don't need more male voices dominating
right.
the space,
right?
Like, just don't. But that's real, right?
Right.
So learning how both being a Black man may create a certain kind of unprivilege, may disempower me within this existing system.
Sure.
But then how my other skill, how the other parts of my identity may bring privilege to the space. And so understanding that dynamic of how both of those things are happening at the same time with me as an art, I am an artist who has a voice and can create and people pay attention to it at the same time. I have a view that may or may not be the view of the world that needs to be had right now.
Right.
Right. So then how do I then learn to use my art in such a way that it services a greater end other than my own kind of my own advancement? Mm-hmm. So that's that third part of. So you have a critical analysis, a self-awareness, and then you got to move into some cultural competence. You got to develop some skill and navigating this thing in different ways and practicing and dealing with people across cultural difference, right? Where it's easy for me to say, because of the way my particular gifts are mixed in me, to say, go in there and speak up for yourself.
Right, right.
You know, and do and get all into my mansplaining to all the women in my life
about
you just did
right.
If you just went and were like me, you would be all right. You know, right? So learning some cultural competence that first off helps me to hear those women in my life who are speaking back to me and saying, "Listen, I need you to pay attention and not talk so much." Mm-hmm. Right. And then secondly, hopefully over time, developing enough cultural competency where I don't enter into the conversation with that same way anymore. And I start to find more beautiful ways of interacting. I start to create spaces where I start to use my voice to grab attention, to focus it in a different direction. I start to draw upon different resources and referencing different people. I remember coming to the realization that every book or movie or anything I ever reference is about a man.
Mm.
Every author, wow. every brilliant person.
Yeah.
You know, and so becoming conscious about what does it mean to go back and reference Audre Lorde instead of reaching for, you know, James Baldwin, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates or whomever else, right? Like to be able to start to question the way I enter into space. Cultural competency is also about historically marginalized persons. So it's not just about historically privileged persons learning how to deal better with historically marginalized persons. It's also about historically marginalized persons learning how to heal from overexposure to these hostile systems that were not meant for them.
Right.
And so all of that work needs to be done. And then finally, you know, if we're going to get towards beloved community, we start with critical analysis. We make a major move towards self-awareness. We make a move towards towards cultural competency. But then we have to get to better practice. So when are we going to do something better? When are we going to do something better? So in the book, even though I don't say it over and over and over again, really what I'm moving people through is that kind of process of thinking about how have I been seeing the world? Where am I in the world? What do I need to understand differently? Now, how do I need to show up in the world differently?
At the end of the book, you've got a kind of a go and do likewise message, right?
Yes. So here's what we call it, the Better Manifesto. It's be better. Do more than just try to feel better. Think and do better. Don't just want or wish or hope or dream. Disrupt and dismantle systems of oppression, especially if they privilege you. Inequity isn't a look. We can be better than that. Feel free to deconstruct and reconstruct anything that falls short of the better you imagine possible. You get no extra points for being right the first time. If you come up short, compost it, plow it under, and grow something better. And remember that we pass the aspiration for better along through our stories. So tell more beautiful, more just, more virtue-filled stories today. It's simple. Better stories, better world.
Melvin Bray, thank you for being on AIJ Cast.
I appreciate you, sir.
Melvin Bray on AIJ Cast. You can find his book and more information about it on his website, better.melvinbray.com. You can also find out more about his facilitation work by going to collabyrinthconsulting.com. That's collabyrinth consulting. On our next episode, singer-songwriter Derek Webb. The only way AIJ Cast happens is because of the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your contributions, your support. You can find out more information on our website, aijcast.com. Just click on the link that says support. You can also follow us and, more importantly, share news about us on social media platforms. Just look for AIJ Cast. Our theme song? Well, that's written and recorded by the band Marred Fame. Each episode is lovingly mixed, engineered, and produced by Al Mudif. The other day, I was asking him about how many hours do you think it takes you to put together one single episode of AIJ Cast?
Well, maybe 50, maybe 20, not about 10.
And I am your host, Marthame Sanders, encouraging you, yes, you, to go and create some beauty of your own. Peace.